So we are now in the period in between Purim and Pesach. So probably starting next week, I want to focus more on Pesach. But today I want to try to focus on the connections we have between Purim and Pesach. We're in this period of the year, which kind of joins together these two holidays. It's not a coincidence that they occur so close to one another. And I'm going to draw a bunch of parallels that we find between the two holidays. And I'll try to understand what the message is that these two holidays are connected. But nothing on the Jewish calendar is a coincidence. Nothing is just kind of happens as random. Everything is there with the message and with the reason. So let's try to see what these connections are. So let's start from the famous concept. When Adar begins, you have to increase your happiness. So if you look on that passage in the Talmud, it's in Maseches Tainus, Tractate Tainus. Rashi explains when it says to increase your happiness when Adar begins, what does it mean? He says because of the miracles of Purim and Pesach. Meaning it's not just that you're happy about Purim, you're happy about Purim and Pesach together. That's how Rashi explains that concept. So we focus so much on the miracles of Purim creating happiness, but Rashi tells us it's not just Purim, it's the entire period of the year coming up. These 2 months of Adar and Nisan are looked at as the joyous months on the Jewish calendar because they contain these festive miracles. And because of that, you increase your simcha for 2 months, the way the Rashi explains it. So already you find that these two holidays are connected with one another. A second connection you find is that in a leap year, when there's 2 months of Adar, in a Jewish leap year, you add an extra month. There's Adar 1 and Adar 2. So the Talmud has a discussion, so during which Adar do you celebrate Purim? Purim is Adar 15. But if there's two Adars, which one is Purim? Adar 1 or Adar 2? So there's a few different opinions, but the way that we practice it in our days, and the way which is the halachic ruling, is that you celebrate Purim in the second Adar. And why is that? So the second Adar. So the Gemara says, why do we celebrate Purim in the second Adar? In order so we can have the redemption of Purim be right before the redemption of Pesach. I mean, in order to make sure those two holidays are one next to the other, we make sure we celebrate Purim in the second Adar. If you were to celebrate Purim in the first Adar during those years, there'd be a month break in between Purim and Pesach. So we don't want to have the extra month in between. We want to make sure both miracles come together. So again, the Talmud is connecting for us these two holidays. We mentioned, I believe, last week in the Purim story that a bulk of the Purim story happens on Pesach. I believe I said this last week. We'll just go back through one more time. The decree of Haman was made in the middle of the month of Nisan. Mordechai found out about the decree on the very day that Haman sent out the letters, which seems to be, I guess, the 13th of Nisan. Pesach is the 15th of Nisan. They fasted when Mordechai and Esther declared the fast for all the Jews for 3 days. That was actually overlapping with Pesach. That year, they did not eat matzah at their Seder. They didn't eat marah at their Seder. They were fasting during the Seder that year. And Haman was killed on the day 2 of Pesach. So you find the actual bulk of the Purim story, the major parts of the Purim story, happen on Pesach itself, on the Jewish calendar. So even though we celebrate Purim in the month of Adar, that's because that was the day slated to kill the Jews. That was 12 months later. But the day in which we fasted and Esther went into the king and Haman was actually killed was on Pesach. So another very powerful connection between the two holidays. Even when you get into the nitty-gritty verses you find in the Megillah, verses, descriptions we find in the Torah about Pesach, you find a lot of parallels. Just to point out two parallels. We know that the story begins with Mordechai being somewhat downtrodden, looked upon negatively by people around him as somebody who was causing problems. He wouldn't bow down to Haman. People were getting upset with him. He was fasting and he was repenting at the king's gate. But by the end of the story, the Megillah tells us that Ish Mordechai Halich Megiddo, Mordechai became greater and greater in the eyes of all around him. Everyone had respect for Mordechai. You find it similarly when it comes to Moshe in the story of Pesach. Moshe comes back to Egypt. He tells the Jews, I'm here to redeem you. He goes into Pharaoh and he says, I'm here to redeem the Jews. And Pharaoh says, I'm making them work extra hard now. And it didn't look so good for the Jews. Moshe seems to have caused them more problems than it was worth. And Moshe comes out from the Pharaoh's palace. And now there was a decree that Jews had to work extra hard. And at that point, the Jews were not so happy with Moshe. They said, what are you doing to us? It's much better if you just stayed out of Egypt and didn't get involved in these issues. Didn't meddle in our affairs. But right before the exodus from Egypt, it says in the Torah, a very similar wording, Ish Moshe gadol ma'o ve'enei abdi paravenei ha'am, that the person Moshe became great in the eyes of Pharaoh's servants and the eyes of the nation. So it was the same progression that both Mordechai and Moshe were looked at as a source of the problem in the beginning of the story. And as the story progresses, they both become greatly respected by all around them, both Jew and non-Jew alike. So that's another point you find, showing a parallel between the Purim and Pesach, between Moshe and Mordechai. Similarly, when the Jews left Egypt, it says, Erev Rav Allah Itam. There was actually a large group of converts that joined on the Jewish people when they left Egypt. A bunch of people from other nations, I guess Egyptians and others, saw the miracles that God performed in Egypt, saw the miracles that the Moshe was involved in, and decided we want to join the Jewish people as well. And we mentioned last week a similar thing in the Megillah. It says that when the miracle of the Megillah happened, and the Jews were able to kill Haman, and respected by all the other people around them, the Megillah tells us, Rabbi Ma'ami Aras Messiah Hadim, that many of the nations, that many of the people of the nation around them wanted to become Jewish, for the fear of Mordechai and the fear of the Jews had fallen upon them. So in both stories, you find that parallel, that at the end of the story, people respected the Jews to the extent they wanted to actually join us. You find that in the Pesach story and in the Purim story. We know that the Pesach story culminates in the Jews standing in Mount Sinai and receiving the Torah. That's clear. We know that's the entire purpose Moshe says about for leaving Egypt was to go to Mount Sinai and receive the Torah. So Moshe is told, and Moshe tells the people. In the Purim story, the rabbis teach us that when the Purim story ends, the Jews reaffirm their commitment to the Torah once again. And even though the first time around they accept the Torah based on the fear of God, they knew if we don't take the Torah, God's going to be upset with us. In the Purim story, they accept the Torah out of love of God. But the Talmud draws the parallel that in both stories, the culmination was that they accepted the Torah from God. In the, yeah. Yeah. That's a good question. I might address it a little bit more later, but the simple answer would be that when it's a life death situation, then you're allowed to work around commandments. You know, you don't have to. If someone says, you know, I'm going to kill you if you don't eat a pork chop, eat the pork chop. You know, so if Mordechai and Esther felt this fast was so crucial to save the Jewish people, they're allowed to cancel matzah that year.
Besides, there are other situations where you, rather than err one way, you don't do the positive command.
You better to remain passive.
Yeah.
Right. You have a good reason.
This is a different from that.
Right. That'd be a different application.
The classic one is shofar on Shabbos. That's just a stronger command, but we don't do it.
Right. I mean, Art's pointing out, we don't blow shofar when Rosh Hashanah is on Shabbos. Even though the Torah says, it's a Torah commandment to blow shofar even on Shabbos. And because the rabbis were concerned that if you blow shofar on Shabbos, you might carry the shofar outside, which you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. So the rabbis had the right to say, remain passive and don't blow the shofar, because we have a good reason to tell you to do that. So that's another point being brought out. But there are times when it comes to certain mitzvahs, especially in a life-death situation, that you'd be allowed to cancel that mitzvah. Another interesting connection you find in the two stories is that Moshe, inexplicably, in a very strange way, was raised in Paro's and Pharaoh's palace. We know that he was taken as an adoptive son by Pharaoh's daughter out of the Nile, and he grew up in the palace of Pharaoh in a way which, you know, it's a very surprising and ironic, you know, youth, childhood that Moshe had. He grew up in Pharaoh's palace. Similarly, Esther ends up in a very strange and inexplicable way in the palace of Achashverosh. So you have the heroes of the story both ending up in unlikely ways in the palace of the ruler of the time. The Megillah tells us that Esther was nosei chen, is the wording used. Esther found grace in the eyes of all who were around her. And again, it could be, the Talmud has a debate. Was Esther actually beautiful, or was she actually unattractive? The Talmud is unsure. Was Esther a beautiful woman or an unattractive woman? So if she's a beautiful woman, we understand why the king liked her, and why she found grace in the eyes of all around her. If she was unattractive, then it's very strange that the king would choose her as his queen. But for some reason, she was able to find grace in his eyes. So too, the Torah tells us when the Jews left Egypt, they found grace in the eyes of all the Egyptians. The Egyptians were willing to give them their utensils, give them clothing, give them money as they left Egypt. So you have this idea in both stories that people who are unlikely to find grace in the eyes of those around them are able to find grace in the eyes of those around them. In both stories as well, another parallel, the hatred of the Jews in these stories is quite sudden and surprising. In Egypt, everything was going well in Egypt. Based on Joseph's leadership of the country, they should have loved the Jews. They should have felt, you know, we should have been the most honored amongst the people. Joseph saved the entire country, not so long before the slavery. However, there was as the Torah says, a new Pharaoh arose and suddenly started enslaving and torturing the Jews. Similarly, in Persia, I don't think we have a record of Jews in Persia being persecuted anyway, but suddenly Haman comes to power and bam, all these decrees fall upon our heads. So again, in both stories you have this surprising and sudden anti-Semitism, and you have a lot of these parallels. You can go through the story and find even more parallels than this. And one more parallel in terms of the observance of the holidays. I mean, we observe them very differently. Obviously, Pesach is a very different observance than Purim, as we all know. But one common denominator you find in both holidays, which I find very interesting, is that these are the only two holidays that are required to tell a story. On Purim, we have to read the Megillah and tell the story of Purim. And on Pesach, at the Seder, we have an obligation to tell the story of the Exodus. When it comes to other holidays, Hanukkah, Shavuos, Sukkot, there's no obligation to tell the story. I mean, it's good to talk about the stories during the holidays, but there's no obligation, there's no mitzvah to do it. But there is a mitzvah that one must tell the story of Purim on Purim by reading the Megillah. And there's a mitzvah that one must tell the story of the Exodus at the Seder when reading the Haggadah. So these two stories must be so essential for every Jew to understand that they have to be told over during those times of year. So this is just a bunch of parallels. I'm sure we can come up with more, but there's a lot of connection between two holidays, despite the time of year and despite everything mentioned in the beginning of the class, that the two miracles have to come together. So we're now in the middle of this period connecting Purim to Pesach, and the question is, what's the meaning of this connection? Like, why must we experience these two different redemptions as one? We're supposed to view them kind of as one chunk of our year. Purim and Pesach come together as one chunk. There's a month in between, but still, they're supposed to be viewed to us as one full picture, full experience, of joy. Both of them are referred to as a geula, a redemption. And what's the idea of redemption? Redemption is when God brings things back to their proper place. The Torah talks about redemption in other forms as well. When in the time of the Jews came into the land of Israel in the book of Joshua, so all the land was divvied up amongst all the tribes. Every family had their piece of land. So the family needed to sell the land. They had financial needs to sell the land. So there's a mitzvah that relatives should go and buy back the land for the family members who had lost the land. That's referred to as the same word, geula, goel, redemption. It's called redeeming the land, because you're putting the land back in its place. You're restoring it back to its original standing. When God redeems us, it's a restoration to the way things are supposed to be. Jews are not supposed to be in exile and persecuted and tread upon. We're supposed to be God's honored people. So when we do the wrong things, we're forced into exile and into these terrible situations. That's the world's in a way which is out of order. It's not supposed to be that way. That's a surprising situation in this world. When God redeems us, God's restoring us back to how we're supposed to be. So Purim and Pesach are supposed to give us the full sense, the full gamut of God's redemption of the Jewish people. Purim and Pesach are an image that comes together to show us how God runs the world and brings things back to who they're supposed to be. And we'll elaborate on this, but we talk about the word hashgacha, about God's divine intervention, the way that God supervises and runs the world. Divine providence. So that comes to us in many different ways. And Purim and Pesach served us as models of divine providence. That's what it shows us. And the divine providence always is trying to bring the world back to its original goals, original state. You have to redeem the Jews, to perfect the world. That's always the goal of divine providence, in one way or the other. So let's try to look at Purim and Pesach in terms of from this perspective, understand how these both together serve as the full image, the full picture of divine providence in our world, and of God trying to redeem us and bringing things back and restoring things to their place. We started the class by pointing out the idea of when Adar begins, you're supposed to increase your simcha, your joy. And the joy we're supposed to increase, Rashi told us, was the joy of Purim and Pesach together. It's because of the miracles of Purim and Pesach we're supposed to increase our joy, and therefore, during the next 2 months, we're supposed to have an increased sense of joy in our lives. So what's the idea of increasing joy? Joy doesn't just mean like singing and dancing and smiling. Joy means there's an inner contentment a person has. The Hebrew has many, many synonyms for joy. Happiness. The common word we use is simcha, right? But there's a list, I think, of maybe 10 or so words which also would imply some form of joy. But in Hebrew, which is Lashon HaKodesh, the holy language, every single synonym has a different connotation to it. So commentaries point out, when we talk about simcha, which is, I think, is probably the most common term we use. We're talking about simcha. What does the word simcha connote? What does it mean? It means an inner feeling of contentment. A person feels complete. A person feels settled. A person feels content with life that's happening to them. There are those who point out that the Hebrew word simcha, the root of that being sin mem ches, relates, and at least how we pronounce it, to the word samach, which is samich memchaf, spelled differently. But samach and sameach relate to one another, so you hear it as they say it. And samach means to be supported. Because one feels that they're supported. They feel that they're taken care of. One feels that they don't have anything lacking, that everything is kind of in its place. You feel simcha, you feel happy. People feel sad when they're lacking. We feel sad when we're lacking something. When we feel happy, when we feel support, when we feel that we're complete, when we feel that we're not lacking anything. So what's the greatest form of simcha a person can have? That when we perceive that God is always there for us, that no matter what's happening in life, even in the most terrible times in life, when we perceive that God is there for us, to care for us, to guide us, to bring us in the right direction, that should bring us to a great form of simcha. Because that means we're always supported. And even somebody who feels that they're just totally lost, they're totally alone, someone who's depressed, somebody's gone through, God forbid, a terrible situation. But if deep down you know this is all God's doing because God loves me and cares for me, then even that can bring to simcha. Even that can bring to joy because deep down inside you know that somebody's there supporting me every step of the way. So when a Jew is going through tough times, we're supposed to focus in on the simcha of feeling supported by God. That everything is God's support, everything is led by God, everything is trying to bring us to a certain goal. And that means that our lives have meaning, that our lives have worth, our lives are going somewhere, our lives have a reason. And God's always trying to bring us in a certain direction. So that's the goal of simcha. Simcha is this feeling of inner contentment, and it comes in many different layers, but the ultimate simcha a person can have, the constant simcha we should have, is the simcha that God is always there for us. We talk about, Ivduas Hashem b'simcha, serve God with simcha. Right, serve God simcha means that the understanding that when I serve God, God is there for me and I'm there for Him. That's the greatest simcha a person can have. That's the greatest joy because someone is always there to support me every single moment of my life. That's the idea of simcha. So these 2 months are supposed to be working on simcha, on that feeling of this inner content, this inner support that we feel from God every step of the way. Now, how does God lead us? How does God guide us? How does God drive the world in the right direction? So there's 2 sweeping approaches that God takes. And I think we've alluded to some of it over the past 2 weeks discussing Purim, but we'll talk about it more at length right now. One of them is referred to as Gilui Panim, which we mean as God performing acts which are exposed and clear, where you clearly could point and say that was an act of God. And the Simcha Hester Panim, where God hides His face, where God is still there caring for the world, intervening, but yet He's doing it in a way which is not so evident, not so clear. The analogy I like to give, which I've given before, but it's always good to review, is from a verse in Shir Hashirim, the Song of Songs. It says, Hineze ulman achar koslenu, says that the man is standing behind our wall, mashgiach min achalonos, he is supervising from the windows, metis min acharakim, he's peering through the cracks. So it's a contrast of supervising through windows and peering through cracks. So I once heard explained that it's a great analogy, picture a parent watching a child in the front yard. So what's the difference if the mother is looking through a window or peering through a crack? The mother looks through the window, the kid can look back and see the mother. If the mother's looking through a crack, so the mother watches can see the kid, but the kid can't see the mother. And there's a major difference. God's always watching over us. At times He does it in ways where we can see, look back and see Him through the window. At times He's doing it by peering through cracks. He's still watching us and guiding us and caring for us, but yet it's through a crack, so we don't see Him anywhere. But yet He's still there. So if we could perceive this, that God is always there, watching over us every step of the way, even when I don't see Him through the window, I know He's peering through the crack, that would lead me to a great sense of joy, because I know God's always there for me. That's what I would know. So this is the full gamut of God's ways in which He runs the world, are one of these different methods. Either He's doing it in an open sense, where you can look back and see Him, and you can point, there's God over there, I see this is God's miracle. And sometimes you don't see that, but yet you understand that God is still watching me, despite the fact I don't see Him. So that's Purim and Pesach represent these 2 different approaches to how God runs the world. Pesach, very clearly, is a time we will call Gilui Panim, God exposing Himself to the world. Which, in a greater sense, was the whole purpose of Pesach. Why did God have to create so many miracles in Egypt? God could have said, poof, and plopped us down in Israel, right? We don't need to have the whole fireworks of the 10 plagues, the splitting of the sea, we don't need to have time in the desert, we could just go straight to Israel. God could do anything He wants. But God says over and over again in the Torah, He wanted to create a spectacle. Because He was trying, at this point in history, to expose Himself to the world. The whole world should perceive there's a God in the world. There's a God who runs the world. There's a God who could overturn nature. There's a God who gives reward and he punishes and he sees good and he sees evil. There's a God out there who could do anything. That was the purpose of the miracles of Pesach. God clearly intervenes in the world to care for his people. He leads us. He rewards us. And it all culminates in the ultimate revelation at Mount Sinai when God reveals himself and speaks to us and gives the Torah. And that's the image of Pesach leading up even to Shavuos. The Pesach is all about God exposing himself to this world. And it was supposed to be an open exposure. It says that when God split the sea, they said, this is my God. And the rabbis tell us that people were able to take a finger and point and say, we perceive God over here. It was so clear that they could point. And there was no image of God, obviously. But it was such a clarity they had of understanding God in this world that they could in a way, point and say, we see God over here. God is here. Big sign. God is here. Right? That's what they could do. That's what happened on Pesach. Now, in Purim, it was the opposite. The miracle of Purim, this is what we discussed over the past few weeks. The miracle of Purim was what we call Hester Panim. God was hidden. God's face was hidden. The word Esther, the Talmud asked the question, where do you find a reference to Esther in the Torah itself? I mean, Esther lived a few thousand years after the Torah was given. Where do you find some sort of hint to her in the Torah? So the Talmud says, Anochi Haster Aster Panai. The verse says, I will hide my face from you, God says. And that is the hint to Esther, because the book of Esther is about God hiding his face. And when God hides his face, you get very scared, because you think God's not with us. You know, the kid's out in the yard, doesn't see his mother anymore, he gets very nervous. I thought she was here watching me, I don't see her anymore. Now I feel so vulnerable, there's nobody here to care for me. And that's what we felt at the times of the Purim story. That's how we felt when we were in Persia under the decrees of Haman and Ahasuerus. We felt like we were very vulnerable. We felt that God had forsaken us. In the book of Esther, there's no miracles that are clearly there, nothing supernatural, nothing out of the ordinary. The name of God is not mentioned anywhere in the Megillah. God's name is not there. It's all about God being hidden. But yet, at the end of the story, the miracle of Purim, we look at as just as powerful as the miracle of Pesach. The redemption we experienced and the outcome of it was in many ways just as great as the outcome of the Pesach miracles. Like we said, it culminates in all the nations respecting us, people wanting to become Jewish, everybody respecting Mordechai, the Jews recommitting to the Torah once again. It ended in the very same atmosphere and a very same situation that Pesach ended with. Very similar things. But it was totally different in that it was all done in behind the scenes. God was acting behind the scenes in hidden ways, which we couldn't see. And even now we can't, you know, we look back at the book of Esther and we read through it. We try to figure out, okay, well, these events all were miraculous. Each one individually doesn't seem miraculous at all. But that was all there. That was all God trying to work behind the scenes. And that's like if somebody plays chess, and there's a checkmate. So if there's a good chess player playing against you, so you have no idea how he ended up making the checkmate. Right? Once the checkmate happens, you can kind of trace back what happened. And the whole time he's kind of working behind the scenes in very devious ways to make everything fall into place, and suddenly, boom, you've lost. I'm terrible at chess, by the way. But my son beats me every time. But God moves the chess pieces around in history, and eventually there's a checkmate on Haman. And we don't know how it happens. You know, you look back and think, wow, how is he hanging over there on the gallows dead? And you kind of look, try to trace it back to the story and think God was working behind the scenes, kind of plotting in very mysterious ways, very hidden ways, to reach a certain goal. I find a very interesting contrast in the story of the Exodus and the story of the Megillah, in that when the Jews are standing at the sea, and they're very, very concerned, very nervous. They tell Moshe, you know, we have the sea in front of us. The Egyptian army is coming to attack. We have nowhere to go. Many of the Jews say it's better that we died in Egypt rather than come here to the sea. Is there a lack of graves in Egypt, they said. So God tells Moshe, he says, just keep on going. What are you doing? Why are you so scared? Don't even pray. He says, just keep on going. And Moshe, and he says, Hashem yilachem lachem, Hashem will fight for you. You guys should be silent. Stop your complaining. He says, stop your prayers. Just march forward. So we're supposed to be silent. We're supposed to let God take care of everything. In the wording used there, it says the word in Hebrew, tacharishun, is to be silent. Tacharishun. And I point that out because we're going to find that same word used in the Megillah. In the Megillah, you find the word tacharishun, be silent, used in the opposite manner. Esther and Mordechai are debating what to do about the decrees that Haman's made against the Jews. Esther's a little nervous, I don't want to go into the king, I haven't been called in, he might kill me. So Mordechai tells him, "Imhacharish tacharishi beis kazos." He says, "If you're silent at this time, then you're going to die." He says, "You can't be silent." So in the story of Pesach, God says, "Quiet. You don't need to. I'll take care of everything. Don't worry. You don't have to worry about it. That's all me." In the story of Purim, Mordechai says the opposite. He says, "No, you have to. You can't be silent." One says, "Tacharish, be silent." One says, "Don't tacharish, don't be silent." And it's really the contrast of these two different approaches God has to the world. When it's a time where God is very clearly exposed in this world, we're experiencing open miracles. So at that point, God says, "I don't need the human being to do anything. I'm going to take care of it all." And that, and the pinnacle of this was the Exodus from Egypt. In a time of Purim, when God is hidden, it's all up to us to make the right moves. Now, God will make it all fall into place. But we have to act. We have to do our part to make sure that we can save the Jewish people. So Esther is told, "You can't be silent at a time like this." If it was Pesach, you could be silent. But Purim, you can't be silent. So these are our two different ways in which God tries to lead the world to its goals. And how do they interplay with one another? I mean, so these are two different methods in which God runs the world, but they interplay with one another in a very important way. I'll give you an analogy that I read from Rav Shlomo Lobi. He writes this analogy. He writes that when a country sends out a spy to a different country, so, and they need to communicate. So oftentimes they'll encode messages. So the spy who is, let's say the U.S. has a spy in Iran, so they'll send him a letter. And the letter on the surface will look like a regular letter. Dear Ahmed, how are you doing? It's nice to see you. You know, hope the weather's good in Iran. You know, love Muhammad, whatever it says, right? That's what the letter would say. But there's something included in that letter. You know, sometimes you can take out, you know, a special light, or special ink, or you can put it into chemicals, and it'll expose in the letter the hidden message. So there's some sort of machine they can use to decode messages. If you go to the Spy Museum, they have all sorts of, you know, message decoding machines you can play with in the Spy Museum in D.C. So he says that's exactly the relationship between Pesach and Purim. Purim is a time of hidden messages, where God is there communicating and performing miracles, but it's hidden. And if you didn't have the proper tools to decode that message, you wouldn't find God in the Purim story. But Pesach gives us the tools. Because Pesach is used as the machine, it's the tool to decode the hidden messages. What does that mean? If we didn't have Pesach, we never saw God intervene in the world to that extent. We look at the Purim story and say, it's a fluke. We would say, you know, it's kind of ironic that Haman's there hanging on the gallows. It's kind of ironic that the Jews are now respected when a few months before they're going to be annihilated. But, you know, it's a lot of coincidences, it's random, it's a fluke. But when God showed us on Pesach that I run the world, and God said I can overturn nature, and God said that my goals are always met one way or the other, and God said that I reward the righteous, I punish the wicked, and I don't care what the laws of nature tell me, I can overturn them. So that gives us the perspective on seeing the rest of history. And that shows us that even when you see times where God is not so apparent, that helps us decode the message. And if you experience Pesach properly, and you take the message of the miracles of Pesach, that helps you to decode the messages of history, including Purim and all the other types of history where God's hidden. So that's the analogy given by Rabbi Wolbe. So he says that Pesach is your decoding tool; it's your machine you use to decode the message. And then history, when God is silent, as it were, throughout history, that's a tool we should use to decode the messages of God throughout the rest of history. Pesach's our tool. So we need both Pesach and Purim. We need to have Pesach to give us the tools to decode the messages. And we need Purim as well, because I'll discuss that in a minute. But I want to share with you a quote from the Ramban Nachmanides. He writes this exact point. He doesn't use the analogy of a spy. He writes the exact points in his commentary on the Torah. He says a famous idea. He says that from the open public miracles, a person then will acknowledge hidden miracles. And he says, in fact, hidden miracles are the foundation of the Torah. He says a very powerful line. She'ein la'adam chelik, a person has no portion in the Torah of Moshe until he believes that all of our matters and all of our situations are all miracles from God. Nothing is natural. Nothing just runs the course of nature. Everything is God. Everything is miraculous. Everything is divine intervention. So Nachmanides tells us that we're supposed to use the open public miracles as a tool to see the hidden miracles in life. And once we do that, we'll understand that all of life is a hidden miracle. Any single person can look back at their lives and kind of trace, like, how did I end up where I am right now? Why is my life where it is right now? And a lot of steps along the way, know, you can see are kind of an interesting thread of events. And during the time we're experiencing them, it didn't seem miraculous to us. It didn't seem like this is God intervening and leading in a certain direction. But you can look back 20, 30, 40, 50 years later and say, wait a minute, how did all that come together in the way that it did? That's a hidden miracle. That's like the Purim story. Everything comes together as one. And you look back and you say, wow, God was taking me somewhere. Now my life did lead me somewhere. But we only will bring God into the equation if we understand Pesach. Only if you understand that God runs the world, which is what was the point of Pesach, at that point you look back at all the regular mundane events of life and say, that's also miracles from God as well. So we need to have Pesach to help us decode the messages. But also at times we know God will act in hidden ways. He can't have constant supernatural miracles. If miracles were constant, they wouldn't be miracles anymore. I mean, by definition, a miracle means that it's kind of an out-of-the-ordinary supernatural experience. But once a miracle becomes commonplace, it's no longer miraculous. It's nature. I mean, really, all nature is a string of constant miracles. I mean, nature is also a miracle. But because it happens in a way which is constant, and we can write it up in a science equation, then we don't see it as a miracle anymore. So if God split seas every single day, it would no longer be miraculous, it would be natural. If a man fell from the sky every single day to feed us, it wouldn't be miraculous, it would be natural. So you can't have open miracles constantly, because then it becomes nature, it's not miraculous anymore. So you have to have the open miracles at times, because God has to paint the sign, you know, God is here. I run the world. Nature doesn't mean anything in my eyes. That's what you need God to tell us every once in a while. It happened on Pesach, it happens occasionally throughout history. But the rest of history will be where God is not performing open miracles, where God's acting behind the scenes. That's the rest of history. But as long as you take in the message from Pesach, and you've trained yourself to perceive God throughout every single event, then you'll see God's miracles every day of your life. And that's ultimately the goal. So from this perspective, Purim and Pesach coming together, this is our lenses that we can have to perceive God in daily life. This time of year gives us perspective that God acts in many ways. God has many tricks up his sleeve, we can call it, you know. And we don't always understand what those tricks are. But if you understand the message of Pesach and Purim, you wear these glasses in life, you can then see that really you're surrounded by miracles every step of the way, just as sometimes the miracles are happening behind the scenes and sometimes they're happening, you know, in an exposed way. Well, before we bench, when you have three men together and you're going to say the blessing after the meal, so we have what you call the mezumen. The mezumen is when you invite each other to bench. So one of the lines we say, it says, Baruch Shechalnu Mishalo V'tuvo Chayinu. Blessed is the one from whom we've eaten, and in his goodness we live. So the Gemara says that if one changes that word, the word we say is V'tuvo Chayinu, in his goodness we live. If you were to say Mituvo Chayinu, we live from his goodness, and it's a very subtle difference. It says if you say you live from his goodness, that person's ignoramus, doesn't understand. If you say we live in his goodness, that's how a scholar speaks. That's what the Gemara says. Now, what's the difference between living from God's goodness and in his goodness? So if you're living from God's goodness, you're saying that, you know, I'm here, there's goodness to God, and sometimes I take from it. If you say I live in God's goodness, that means that I'm totally surrounded. I'm totally ensconced in God's goodness, all around me. And the perspective a Jew has to have is that God's goodness is surrounding me every single step of the way. It's not that I occasionally take from God's goodness, like occasionally God gives me some nice things. That's not how we're supposed to view it. We're supposed to view it that I live betuvo, I live in his goodness, that I'm totally surrounded. I'm in a sea of God's goodness every single moment of my life. That's how we're supposed to look at it. And someone says, mituvo chayinu, the Gemara says that person's an ignoramus. He doesn't understand how God works. That's the Gemara says. So we can just open up our siddur, read the words, we say the right words. But to understand what the words mean is our goal. Our goal is to understand betuvo means that we're totally surrounded by God's goodness every moment of our lives. So this is one perspective on the connection of Purim Pesach. But there's another layer to this. I just want to share another point about that connection. One of the major, or the major event on Pesach, was when God chose the Jews to be his people. Right? Pesach, when God takes the Jews out of Egypt, God declares us as the chosen people. God says, you are my people to carry my mission in this world. I'm taking you to Mount Sinai. I'm giving you the Torah. And you're going to become my special nation. So if God chooses the Jews to be a special nation, that's the miracles of Pesach. So that, by definition, will mean that there will have to be hidden miracles throughout the rest of history. What do I mean by that? Because God has a plan. Right? When God says, you're my nation, you have a mission, God has a plan for the world. If there's a plan, if God has a plan, God's plan will happen, one way or the other. God's plan will come into fruition. There's no way out of it. God doesn't make mistakes. God doesn't fail, right? So if God has a plan, you can't foil God's plans. If God has a plan, it will occur. So if God will bring us to that goal, then we have a mission and a purpose. So then it'll have to be that even when God is not so apparent, he's still guiding the world to his goals, because God's not going to give up on his goals, that's for sure. So Pesach tells you God has a plan for the world. That's what Pesach tells you. And then Purim is the model that even when you don't think God is doing anything to bring the world to his plan, he's still working towards his plan. Right? You think that your chess opponent is just moving pieces around randomly. You don't see any goal in housing me a checkmate. Right? You don't know. But if it's a master chess player, right, you know he has a plan. Right? You know it. You know what the plan is, but you know he has a plan. So if God says, I have a plan, you know, God is the master chess player. So if God says, I have a plan, and things are happening around us don't seem to be contributing to that plan, you have to know, it must contribute to that plan somehow. There has to be miracles happening behind the scenes here. It says that we mentioned earlier, in the Megillah, that when they fasted over Pesach, which means that they did not eat matzah that year on Pesach. They didn't have maror. They may have told the story of the Exodus that night, but they didn't eat their Seder that year. Imagine a Seder without food. It'd be quite a different experience, right? So their Seder had no food that year. They cancel Pesach. And it says, the way that the Vilna Gaon describes it, he quotes, he cites a Medrash that tells us, what was their logic? Mordechai said, well, if there's no Jews, then there's no matzah and there's no maror. I mean, matzah and maror are here for the Jews, right? So if there aren't any Jews left, if we're all going to be killed, then what's the purpose of the matzah and the maror? So we don't have to have matzah and maror this year. Now, what's the depth of this statement? So I think the idea is this, that Pesach, as we're saying, guarantees there should be miracles like Purim. Because Pesach tells us that God's plan will prevail no matter what. No Haman can come and foil God's plan. Hitler can't foil God. No one can foil God's plans. And one way or the other, God's plans are going to make it through. And that's called hidden miracles. That's called redemption. Because God's going to make sure that nobody in this world can ever foil his plans. So when there's Pesach, there's Purim. But if there's no Purim, if we can say that somebody can come and destroy the Jews, if that's possible, if God's plans can be foiled, if God's plans can be somehow ruined, then Pesach's also meaningless. Because then that means that God didn't really choose us as a people with a mission. They go together. So if we will, Pesach means that we will always prevail one way or the other. We're going to make it through. There has to be a finish line. We're going to make a finish line. We will succeed. So therefore, if Pesach happens, that guarantees that Purim will happen as well. Because Purims mean that even those times in history where God seems to be hidden, and people try to do things to us which seem to somehow go against God's plans, even that will be somehow circumvented. And that's what Purim is. It's circumventing those who try to foil God's plans. If we can't have a Purim miracle, then Pesach is rendered meaningless at that point. Because Pesach is all about the fact that God does have a mission for the world. If there's no Purim miracle, then Pesach also has no meaning. The question I would ask, though, is that we said, if there's no Jews, there's no matzah and there's no maror. Now, I wouldn't have thought that you eat maror, right? If you're fasting, and you're trying to focus in on the fact that Jews are going through a very difficult and bitter time, maybe they should skip the matzah, they could skip the brisket, and they could skip the matzah ball soup. But they should still eat the maror. I mean, the bitterness of the maror seemingly fits very much into what's happening in the Purim story. Right? Maybe they should eat the maror. What's the symbolism of the maror? But I think it's the same exact idea. Even the maror shows the mission and the goals of the Jewish people. Why is that? Because when you're given a mission and a task, that means that, let's say somebody is at work, and the boss comes and gives them a certain task to perform. That's because the boss trusts them. He feels they're responsible. But if you have responsibility, you're also held accountable for your errors. Maror is the message to us that because we're so special, and because we're chosen, yes, there'll be freedom and there'll be redemption, but there also might be bitterness. Because if you're held to higher standards, and you're given responsibilities, and you're given privileges, that means that you're also accountable for your errors and for your shortcomings. So the Jews that year, not only did they skip the matzah, they skipped the maror. Mordechai said, well, if Haman has the ability to annihilate the entire Jewish people, that means that God never really trusts us with any special mission, because no human being can foil God's plans. So it must be we're not so special, God has no plans for the world, and therefore we don't need the matzah, we certainly don't need any redemption, we also don't need the maror. We have no responsibility or accountability either, because our actions are all meaningless, because we're going to be annihilated. That was the statement made. So this is the even skipping the Marla here was the same message. They're showing that since Pesach tells us that we have responsibility, we have a special mission to perform in this world. If you skip Pesach, you're recognizing the fact that our mission is not all that. We don't really have much of a mission. Our mission is pretty meaningless. So Mordechai says that if Haman's going to kill us all, our mission from Pesach is also rendered meaningless. So we're going to skip Matzah Mara this year. But once the miracles happen and God saves us, when Purim occurs, that reinforces our mission from Pesach. That shows us that no, the mission will always prevail. The mission will succeed. The Jews will be God's chosen people. The Jews will always make it through. And God's miracles will always bring us to that finish line. That's what it means. So so these are two messages that are very related you find between Pesach and Purim. Number one is this full gamut of seeing God's intervention and providence in our world. And number two is to understand how God's mission to the Jews given to us on Pesach will always prevail. And Purim is the symbol to us that even when things look very bleak, even when things look very terrible, even God is nowhere to be found, still God's plans will come through one way or the other. That's what it tells us. Now the truth is, even though we look at it as having Purim and Pesach, we got it backwards. In the Jewish calendar, Pesach really comes first, because Pesach is in the first month of the year. The Torah calls Nisan the first month, and Purim is the 12th month. So we perceive, yeah, Purim comes and Pesach comes, but actually it's the opposite. Really, Pesach is month number one, and Purim is month number 12. You know, the first of Nisan is actually a New Year's. We Rosh Hashanah also, that's a different discussion why that's our New Year's. But the Torah refers to Nisan as the first month, and Adar as the 12th month. So really, Pesach comes before Purim. But the way you view it then is that Pesach and Purim are the bookends on the Jewish year. You have month number one is the miracles of Pesach, month number 12 is the miracles of Purim, and that means that our entire year is bracketed off by miracles of redemption. Which means that just like month 1 and month 12 are miracles of redemption, so that shows you everything in between is also miracles as well. Everything's miracles, like we quoted before from Nachmanides. So Purim and Pesach represent to us, these are the two points of Jewish history. You have Pesach as kind of the high perspective. You're looking from the top of the mountain, you're seeing God in his most open form. Purim is seeing God in his most hidden form. But the entire Jewish year is summed up by these two holidays, because it's showing us that every single month throughout the Jewish year also falls into the framework of God's miracles, God's intervention, and God's leading the world to its final goal. So, before we came to this class, you may have thought that the simcha, the happiness of Purim, is supposed to end at Purim, at least end at the end of Adar. But really, the happiness of Purim is supposed to carry on through Nisan. That happiness should continue. Because the two go together. Nisan and Adar are two months that have to be kept close together. The messages overlap to one another because it's all about how God runs the world and the miracles which God provides for the Jewish people. So our job now, as we approach Pesach, as we come off Purim and approach Pesach, our job is to use this time of year to try to perceive God's miracles more keenly in our lives. To be able to perceive where do we find God in our daily lives. Where do you see open miracles? Which you still might see small miracles sometimes. Sometimes things happen which are quite miraculous. Or where do you find hidden miracles? Where do you find God moving the chess pieces around to break things into place? You know, I'm sure everyone thinks through their own personal lives, thinks through more recent history, current events, or even previous events, or history as a whole. You see chains of miracles. You see chains of God's intervention. So this is the time of year to focus on this. And as we approach Pesach, and Pesach, the goal in Pesach is to educate ourselves, educate our children, educate everyone around us in the idea of God's running of the world, how God intervenes, God leads, and God brings the world to a purpose. That's always our goal. So we shall utilize the time of year. I would call putting on new lenses in our glasses. And then we put on the divine intervention lenses. And you're able to see the world differently. That's our goal. Purim and Pesach give us lenses. That's what they do. So if we can take those lenses and apply them to our lives, we'll be able to achieve the real simcha, which is to feel that God, if you feel that God's with you every step of the way, that's when you really feel happy, that's when you really feel content. That's always our goal. Any questions?